Hey everyone, many of you are aware of my distaste for Bobby Kennedy, the maniac who Trump named head of HHS. Well, he's not the only Trump appointee who's a science-denying monster. If you thought someone who denies the germ theory of disease being in charge of public health was bad, how about a climate change denier in charge of the EPA? That's good old Lee Zeldin. Let's talk about him. As we've discussed before, every single member of Trump's cabinet is a fucking nightmare. It truly is a horror show that is unrivaled in American history. As a science communicator, I tend to focus on those who deny science, especially science that is critical to their specific function. So apart from public health, we can obviously turn to the environment. The Environmental Protection Agency, or EPA, was created by President Richard Nixon in 1970 to consolidate federal pollution control responsibilities. This was in response to specific incidents in the 1960s, like a massive 3 million gallon oil spill off the coast of Santa Barbara and the highly polluted Cuyahoga River in Ohio bursting into flames. It's true, the government once cared about curbing pollution. Kind of funny how the formerly disgraced Richard Nixon looks like a goddamn knight in shining armor compared to modern standards, don't you think? Anyway, it's quite logical to conclude that private corporations shouldn't be able to just dump toxic sludge in the water and poison the air and what have you, so the EPA was formed to create and enforce laws that prevent them from doing that. I know, big government is at it again, always doing a communism and stopping the poor billionaires from having all their fun. Now, sketchy corporate shills heading large departments in the U.S. government is not brand new. Numerous secretaries have come directly from positions lobbying for defense contractors, or Wall Street, or pharma, or big energy. But the wholesale denial of central pillars of science that define the role of a position is pretty fucking unprecedented. Only two climate change deniers have ever been head of EPA: Scott Pruitt, appointed by Trump in 2017, and Lee Zeldin, appointed by Trump in 2025. Go Donald, two for two. While Scott rejected the firm and irrefutable fact that carbon dioxide emissions are the primary driver of climate change, which is objectively happening, Lee has already enacted major efforts towards rolling back environmental protections of all varieties. He headlined the fringe conservative Project 2025 adjacent Heartland Conference, which promotes climate change denial of the most cartoonish variety, the first EPA head to ever do such a thing, and he was treated like a fucking rock star by all the fossil fuel execs who have been waiting for a guy like this for decades. If you'd like to think that this is coming from a place of scientific expertise, think again. He's a lawyer and politician. He knows nothing about climate science, or any science, at all. He's a puppet for deregulation, nothing more. And dismantling the EPA is indeed one of the day one priorities of Project 2025, so that should put his appointment in the proper context. The purpose of this video is not to convince anyone that climate change is real. It is. Anthropogenic climate change is objectively real. There is no arguing this. If you need help understanding why this is the case, watch my exceptionally thorough video debunking the script of lies peddled by Matt Ridley, the coal baron. It goes through a mountain of primary literature, demonstrating the precise amount of warming that has occurred since a pre-industrial baseline, the catastrophes that await us should certain levels of warming be reached, and the timeline we're on for that to happen. It's about 20 years, by the way. The science is not vague or inconclusive in the slightest, and I am going to operate according to that firm knowledge in this video. The goal today is to look at Lee's policies and demonstrate that he is a gigantic bag of dicks whose only purpose is to do everything he can to assist the private sector in destroying the environment and severely endangering the entire global human population. Sound good? Great. First things first, under Lee, the EPA repealed the 2009 endangerment finding, which stated that greenhouse gas emissions threaten public health and welfare, since they fucking do, and which is the underpinning of nearly all climate regulations under the Clean Air Act for all major pollution sources. This repeal eliminates all greenhouse gas emission standards and may very well lead to a broader undoing of more regulations. So basically, the head of the EPA said, "Hey everyone, pollute the air as much as you want." Stunning, no? Plenty of experts have made appropriately critical statements, citing the fact that there is zero basis for arbitrarily overturning the firm results of decades of research. But Lee and Trump shot back with blah blah libtards blah blah Obama something something. Next, not directly pertaining to Lee, but Trump has also decided to halt a research initiative involving over 900 deep-sea ocean sensors distributed around the Pacific and Atlantic Oceans. These monitor temperature, salinity, change in ocean currents, and more. One of the ramifications of climate change beyond simply higher average global temperatures is increased melting of the polar ice caps, which introduces massive amounts of fresh water to salty oceans. Fresh water is less dense than salt water, so this disrupts natural density-driven circulation, which we call ocean currents. These currents are essentially huge conveyor belts of water that regulate climate and weather patterns, bringing warmer water to the poles and cooler water to the equator. As this disruption continues with increased warming, apart from the enormous problem of sea level rise, there are issues regarding ocean acidification, fishing, hurricanes, rainfall, droughts, and therefore agriculture. We are talking about widespread crop failures, which could lead to mass starvation. It's a complete catastrophe. So not only did Trump decide we're going to do absolutely fuck all to prevent it, he wants to make sure we can't even monitor how close we are to all this shit happening. If we're blind to the damage, nobody can be held accountable, right? And why limit your careless destruction to America when you can fuck over the whole world, right? Moving right along, as much as I would love to not have to talk about Bobby Kennedy for a single day in my life, Lee's crusade of science denial overlaps tremendously with Bobby's MAHA movement. These two figures are not just about denying pillars of science, but also loosening regulations for harmful substances. First up, polyfluoroalkyl substances, or PFAS. These are so-called forever chemicals, meaning they do not readily degrade like most other compounds. Their accumulation in soil and water, which leads to human exposure, is linked to cancer and other health issues. Remember, Bobby wouldn't shut up about these things during his 2024 presidential campaign. The potential harm they cause was one of his favorite talking points for seeming like a champion of the people. Keep that in the back of your head as we get some background information on these substances. The environmental persistence of PFAS stems from the fundamental properties of fluorine. As the most electronegative element on the periodic table, the introduction of fluorine into organic molecules significantly alters their physicochemical properties. The strength of the carbon-fluorine bond gives these substances high thermal and chemical stability, and polymers filled with these bonds exhibit a surface tension that is much lower than that of conventional polymers. The definition of PFAS is continuously evolving. Generally, we are talking about chemicals with at least one perfluorinated methyl group, CF3, or a perfluorinated methylene group, CF2. Commercially, PFAS are produced via two main pathways, electrochemical fluorination and fluorotelemetric methods. These different industrial manufacturing processes allow for millions of potential structural variations, and there are indeed thousands of such compounds that are widely used. PFOA, or perfluorooctanoic acid, and PFOS, or perfluorooctane sulfonate, are the two most prevalent contaminants, often referred to as legacy PFAS. These are used in the manufacturing of Teflon for nonstick cookware, waterproof clothing, stain-resistant carpeting, packaging, surfactants, all kinds of stuff. They're very neat and useful compounds with many applications, but they do not belong inside the human body. Good so far? Now, unfortunately, this enormous diversity of PFAS variants presents a major challenge due to the severe data gaps in their toxicity. Shorter chain alternatives, often called emerging PFAS, are not necessarily safer than the legacy compounds, and the smaller compounds can also be volatile enough to be detected in the atmosphere. In aquatic models, these newer variants trigger tissue-specific disruptions, including enzyme modulation and inhibited antioxidant pathways in the digestive system. These are findings that highlight the need for new, comprehensive biomarker assessments to monitor the effects of emerging PFAS. Having no data on most of these compounds makes it a stupid gamble not to regulate them, given the toxic properties observed in the few PFAS we actually have a good amount of data on. The toxicological profile of PFAS was first brought to light in the 1950s. Early academic research demonstrated that these compounds bind to proteins in human blood. Researchers at DuPont, one of the largest manufacturers at the time, received preliminary reports which revealed that PFOA exposure led to hepatomegaly, or enlarged liver, in rats. These findings were largely withheld from regulatory bodies, allowing unmitigated environmental disposal to continue near manufacturing sites. Unlike classic persistent organic pollutants, which are often stored in fatty tissues, PFAS mimics the properties of surfactants and fatty acids. This tendency biomagnifies PFAS up the food chain by binding to serum proteins and liver tissue. Modern epidemiological and toxicological consensus confirms that PFAS exposure is detrimental to human health, while the bioaccumulation mechanism is not well understood. Computational simulations reveal that short-chain variants spontaneously aggregate into submicelles, whereas long-chain compounds must adsorb onto the cell membrane surface before translocating across it. Bioaccumulation of these compounds has been linked to liver and kidney disease, thyroid and reproductive dysfunction, elevated serum cholesterol, and testicular cancer. The legacy compounds PFOA and PFOS are routinely detected at higher concentrations in human serum than any other PFAS variants. This high systemic prevalence is concerning given their recent carcinogenic classifications by the International Agency for Research on Cancer, which designated PFOA as a Group 1 carcinogen, meaning carcinogenic to humans, and PFOS as a Group 2B carcinogen, meaning possibly carcinogenic to humans. Various PFAS remediation strategies have been developed, but the vast scale and complex matrix of contaminated media present challenges. While contaminated water can be actively routed through localized treatment infrastructure, soil contamination remains more difficult due to the immobilization of PFAS within the soil, slowly entering the groundwater over time. Longer-chain PFAS can also degrade into shorter-chain PFAS, which are generally more difficult to remove. To address this contamination, engineers utilize both destructive and non-destructive treatment methods. This 2022 paper outlines a field demonstration towards remediation of PFAS in groundwater via a coupling ion exchange resin. This 2025 paper outlines a broad overview of the status of these treatment efforts and barriers to large-scale implementation, and will be linked below. Deploying these methods past the laboratory scale remains a large challenge due to high energy costs and new infrastructure requirements. Non-destructive methods primarily rely on adsorption using activated carbon or polymers. They generate secondary waste that requires further destructive treatment or high-temperature incineration, which can emit volatile PFAS into the atmosphere. Destructive methods like electrochemical oxidation and supercritical water oxidation offer rapid and permanent destruction, but they suffer from high electrode costs and significant energy demands. Photocatalysis and the use of plasma tend to give incomplete degradation, which leads to shorter-chain PFAS and toxic halogen byproducts. The efficiency of these systems is also severely compromised in real-world matrices due to competing organic material that lowers oxidation efficiency. We do not yet have the technology to effectively remove PFAS from aqueous solutions, rendering immediate policy interventions the most viable strategy to mitigate this environmental crisis. In other words, since we don't yet know how to get rid of the stuff, we should try to figure out how to stop introducing it to the environment in high quantities. Okay, that may have been slightly more science than you were looking for, but even if not all of that stuck, the general conclusion everyone can confidently reach is that these substances are damaging to the human body. Therefore, their ingestion should be avoided as much as possible, which requires that their production and usage be strictly regulated by, oh, I don't know, perhaps a government agency whose entire purpose is to do exactly that. Lee is the head of such an agency, the only one in fact. What did he decide to do about this problem? He proposed to rescind federal limits on PFAS in drinking water, which were established by the Biden administration. That's right. While establishment Democrats tend to do the absolute bare minimum to abide by something resembling environmental protection, Republicans characterize even that as ludicrous government overreach and race to demolish the tiny effort put forward to maintain the safety of the citizenry, denigrating them while doing so. In conjunction with this, water suppliers that were given until 2029 to comply with basic standards will now be given until 2031. So that's two more years of doing nothing about harmful compounds in drinking water nationwide. With worthless frauds like Bobby and Lee, it's nothing but say one thing and do another. They'll build up a big platform talking about the nasty chemicals from the evil corporations because that's how you garner support from the public whether you're telling the truth or not. And then they use the political power they amass to make sure we are at greater risk than ever from these very same chemicals. It's like an abusive boyfriend saying, "Baby, I would never hurt you," right before unleashing a fury of drunken rage on your face. Demonstrating that traditional media still occasionally has a spine, The New Yorker ran a 7-page piece in April called "Can the EPA Survive Lee Zeldin?" written by Pulitzer Prize-winning top staff writer Elizabeth Colbert. The subtitle reads, "The agency, which was founded to protect the environment and human health, has canceled safety regulations, supported coal, and stopped caring about climate change." A summary paragraph notes the following. In a little more than a year, Zeldin has transformed the EPA from an agency devoted to protecting human health and the environment into one that, more or less openly, sides with polluters. He has packed the EPA's upper echelons with former industry lobbyists, scrubbed entire databases of information from its website, and dissolved whole departments. Under his leadership, the agency has ditched a long list of rules that industries had objected to, including regulations aimed at cutting Americans' exposure to arsenic, a known carcinogen, mercury, a potential neurotoxin, and PM2.5, a form of very fine soot that has been shown to cause asthma and lung disease. The EPA has not only abandoned its own efforts to rein in greenhouse gas emissions, it has stepped in to prevent states from taking action. Amidst these concerns, Trump has recently moved to slash EPA's budget by 55%, a move that has generated bipartisan outrage. An already underfunded agency will be rendered essentially impotent. Clean water infrastructure, ability to respond to emergencies, important research, all of this will essentially vanish because Trump can't spare less than his own personal net worth to ensure a modicum of safety for the public. It is difficult to convey what an enormous betrayal this is. It is also difficult to find a better example to exemplify the ethos of the Trump administration. This is a government for billionaires only. This is a government that steals tax dollars from its citizens and gives them nothing in return except for elevated cancer risk. Virtually every social service has been eradicated, every consideration, every protection. The Trump administration is quite legitimately a criminal organization, a literal felon hiring other criminals to steal our health and wealth from us. The effects of figures like Lee and Bobby and Russ Vogt and everyone else in Trump's cabinet will linger for decades. Even the most progressive administration imaginable, over 8 full years in office, could not even begin to scratch the surface on the damage currently being done to every sector of government. Forget gerrymandering. Forget the assault on civil rights. We are talking about the very water we drink and the air we breathe. These are the things that most fundamentally shape our ability to exist in good health and seek happiness. No more fundamental constitutional violation could be conceivable. And while the public suffers, all we get is nonstop gaslighting from the Trump administration, much like childish communications from WhiteHouse.gov, such as this embarrassing one about the mythical trans mice. Official statements from department websites like EPA.gov are now nothing but propaganda. EPA advances comprehensive PFAS strategy with legally defensible, practical, scientifically sound drinking water protections. My favorite part is that legally defensible is listed first, meaning that it's dressed up with legal jargon that a crooked lawyer could push through court, even though it's actually all bullshit. But don't worry, this is a holistic approach that tackles PFAS across its full life cycle to make America healthy again. Yes, that's right, Bobby has his hands in this too, so you know it's good. They are correcting failures from those stupid jerks Biden and Harris. They're advancing gold standard science on PFAS. Of course, once Russ Vogt's OMB ruling goes through, that will just be code for research that confirms the state-sanctioned narrative. They're taking on PFAS the right way, across the full life cycle and built to last. That's code for, instead of preventing it from getting into the water, we will make up solutions to get it out after the fact that definitely won't work. And, of course, a little bit justifying the 2-year extension, saying that everyone who complies with their agenda will get the extension, and those who don't will not. It's just completely detestable that this is now the output of the American government across every single department. Not a little lie here and there, not a little redressing of the truth. We are talking about full-scale gaslighting and reality reversal. The announcement that they are going to do the precise opposite of what they are doing. To get some additional perspective, let's speak with a few experts in the field. Those of you who watched my video on Matt Ridley that I mentioned earlier will remember Andrew Dessler, a professor of atmospheric sciences at Texas A&M, the director of the Texas Center for Extreme Weather, and co-author of The Science and Politics of Global Climate Change. Perhaps he can weigh in on some of these issues. Andrew, thanks so much for joining us. So I want to talk about these two things in particular here. One thing that I mentioned to my viewers was this repealing of the 2009 endangerment finding. I was hoping you could tell us a little bit about what this finding was, how it relates to the Clean Air Act, and what kinds of things we can expect now that it's been repealed.
Right. So the Clean Air Act has written into it, and let me just say, I'm not a lawyer and I'm not quoting directly from the law, but this is essentially what it says, is it says that any pollutant, something that you release into the atmosphere that is shown to endanger human health or welfare, must be regulated by the EPA. So there is no choice on that. And we reached that point in the early 2000s. Some environmental organizations petitioned the EPA. They said carbon dioxide, it endangers people's health and welfare. You should regulate it. And that was the George W. Bush EPA. It basically said, no, we're not going to do it. So they sued them. It actually went up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court in 2007, Massachusetts versus EPA, basically confirmed that the Clean Air Act said you had to do it. And so then it just determines, is carbon dioxide a danger to human health and welfare? And that is made by the EPA. And so Obama took over in 2009, and his EPA issued a statement which said, yes, carbon dioxide is a threat to human health and welfare. And I should add, this is actually sort of amusing, that Bush actually asked his EPA the same thing, and his EPA, they got together, they said, of course this is dangerous. And so they sent an email to the White House saying, yes, it's dangerous. And the White House refused to open the email. They just said, we're not going to open this email and send us another opinion. And basically, this was about 6 months before the election, and they just decided they were going to run the clock out. They knew they'd get sued, but they were going to leave it for the next president. So the next president was Obama. His EPA looked at it. They reached, of course, this is a danger to human health and welfare. So they passed the endangerment finding. Now, the endangerment finding really works as the bedrock to a lot of U.S. climate regulations because they kind of rely on this for the justification to do it. And so this has been sort of the white whale of fossil fuel interests to get rid of the endangerment finding that would allow them to try to sort of undercut the foundation of U.S. climate policy. And so they've been trying for a very long time in February, I think it's February of this year, the EPA just said, we're rejecting it.
Just the all of the decades of research in this field that have arrived at this conclusion. Nuh-uh. That's basically what happened.
Okay. Well, I mean, so to be fair to the EPA, they didn't argue the science. In fact, if you go back to last summer of 2025, they did a draft of their order, and there they said, oh, the science is uncertain and blah, blah, blah. And actually they got so much pushback from that, that they actually dropped all of that. So now they're making a purely legal argument that the Clean Air Act is written in a way that it doesn't cover CO2. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not going to try to explain what it is because I probably couldn't, but just they're actually not making a scientific argument here. They're making a legal argument.
Okay, so the science remains sound. They, admit, I suppose, in not pushing back on that. But we can't allow for this to be the basis of all of this regulation. That's what they're saying.
Right. I think what they would argue, what a lot of people who want to sound like they care about the world would say is, well, you know, Congress should pass a law, without understanding that Congress is sort of hopelessly deadlocked on this. The only way to make progress on the problem is really through executive actions. So things like Obama had his Clean Power Plan and things like that. That is really the only way, I think, at least right now, we're going to be able to make progress on this. Because I'm sure everybody out there understands that, you know, fossil fuel interests are incredibly powerful, and they've spent decades paying off politicians so that the politicians no longer legislate on behalf of us, the citizens. They legislate on behalf of them, the fossil fuel companies. And so it's very hard to get policy through when fossil fuel interests can pay essentially infinite amounts of money to politicians to not get the laws through.
Right. So with the repealing of this finding, I mean, obviously this administration is arguably the most friendly to these interests that we've seen in a very long time, if not ever. So is it really as bad as, hey, everyone pollute as much as you want now? Is that where we're at?
You know, I hate to say it, but I think that's basically yes. I don't know if you saw, Trump just pardoned a bunch of people who had been, you know, convicted and penalized for air quality violations. They've also reduced, again, I'm not a lawyer, but you know, if you violate the Clean Air Act, it's no longer a criminal violation. It's now a civil violation. So they can sue you, but nobody's going to go to jail. I mean, they really don't, I don't know what goes on in anybody's heads, but it seems like they really don't care about pollution.
Yeah. Why should they?
Well, no, that's right. Because the billionaires who give them money, they live in clean places and they can have, you know, whereas a lot of the people who live in the most polluted areas are minority, they're poor, they're the people who have no political power, and they're certainly not giving money to super PACs.
Yeah.
It all goes back to the money.
It's just another form of class warfare, and essentially, I mean, what is your impression of what is the global scientific community? How do they react to this decision? What are they thinking? Just looking at America, like how is this happening? what are they saying?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think at this point nobody is surprised. It's like, well, of course, this is what they would do. You know, I think they think it's very sad. I mean, the U.S. has been, since World War II, we've been a leader in of the scientific community. I mean, so many Nobel Prize winners from the U.S. We, you know, a U.S. PhD is the gold standard. Everybody in the world wants a U.S. PhD. That's, you can go anywhere with a U.S. PhD. I mean, it's our research, our economy, all of the discoveries in AI, medicine. I mean, research and science have been so good for the U.S. and so good for the world. And I think people just see our scientific system as imploding. I mean, that's, if there's one thing I think your viewers need to understand, nothing else, it's this: the policies that are being implemented now will make the U.S. a non-scientific country, a country that doesn't have scientists in it, doesn't lead the world in research. And, you know, it's our economy and the country is going to suffer because of that.
Right. The ROI on what we've done scientifically. Yeah, we're sacrificing all that. It's economically makes no sense.
It does. Yeah. I mean, we're right. Fighting this war for the battle of the 21st century with countries like China who understand the value of science.
Right.
And, you know, we're just laying down, you know, we're just laying down our weapons and turning and walking away. We're not even going to battle them.
Right.
They're going to be the scientific supreme leader of this century.
Yeah.
And the same thing is true with renewable energy. I won't go into that. But, you know, we're also giving away the energy source of the 21st century, which is, you know, what they call the electricity stack of electric motors and batteries and green energy. Anyway, that's for another podcast.
Another discussion. Yeah, no, all for the short-term payoff for the oligarchy. But I did a whole video on Russ Vogt's OMB ruling, so they're aware of the extent of the horror that is occurring. Okay, so let's just talk about the other thing. So I talked a little bit in my video here about Trump removing the ocean sensors, but I'd love to get into some more detail. Can you tell us about the processes that are affecting ocean currents? How close are we to slowing or even completely halting these currents? And what kinds of devastating impact will that have globally?
Right. That's a really good question. I think people don't think enough about the oceans in the climate system as they should. So the oceans transport an enormous amount of heat around the planet. So if you look at the tropics, so the equator to 30 degrees in both hemispheres, about a lot more sunlight comes in than heat goes out to space. And so because the tropics aren't heating up, that means that it has to be exporting energy. And the oceans are one of the big ways that you get heat from the tropics to the high latitudes. where it can be the heat can escape to space from high latitudes. And so people are probably familiar with the Gulf Stream. That's this current of really hot water that comes from the Caribbean and moves up through the Atlantic, and then it warms the high latitudes. It's why England has, I won't say a nice climate, but a not a super cold climate like Moscow. It's because of the heating from the ocean. And so we know that the what they call the Atlantic meridional overturning circulation, they call it the AMOC, I'll call it the AMOC, is sort of the big circulation. The Gulf Stream is part of it, and they know that the AMOC had this overturning circulation that brings warm water north has shut down in the past, probably about 12,000 years ago during a period called the Younger Dryas. It stopped, and we understand why. That was from fresh water from melting glaciers at the end of the Ice Age dumping into the North Atlantic and changing the buoyancy of the surface water, so it wasn't hot, it wasn't dense enough to sink.
Right, because of the discrepancy in salinity, because you have heavy atoms and salt, so that makes a difference.
That's right. So fresh water is less dense than seawater. And so if you dump a lot of fresh water on, you essentially put a cap on the ocean, and the water doesn't sink. And this meridional overturning circulation is density driven. It's a density driven circulation. So you have this over, so we know it's shut down in the past. So that should concern everybody because, things that have happened in the past can happen again. And now the reason won't be the same. We don't have big ice sheets on North America melting, but you can put, people have run very detailed ocean models, and the heating of the high latitudes, which is where a lot of the global warming is occurring, will also change the density of the ocean, and that could also slow down the circulation. Now, is it going to stop is actively debated. Not something I actually worry about that much. The models don't predict it'll stop. The models show the circulation slowing down, but the models are very linear. They tend not to get super nonlinear behavior. So, but still, we don't, a lot of people are working on the problem. Anyway, getting back to your question. One of the key things that scientists need in order to understand any complex system is you need to have lots of observations. If you don't have observations, the climate system is just a black box with some knobs that you're twiddling, and you need to have observations to understand it. And so we need to instrument the globe. So we have satellites that are measuring things in the atmosphere. We've got stations on land, and we have things in the ocean because we need to be able to measure these very slight currents. We want to measure how much CO2 is in the water because a lot of the CO2 goes into the oceans. These are all things that we need to measure. And what you also understand is that if you want to stop science, if you want science to stop, you want to kill the observations. And again, I don't know what goes on in anybody's heads in this administration, but I can say what they're doing is indistinguishable from what someone would do if they wanted to kill science. Kill Earth science. They're going after the satellite missions. They're terminating them. They are, stuff that doesn't make any sense. They're cutting the number of balloon launches the Weather Service is doing. The
It's
things that we.
not even expensive in the grand scheme of things. It's the perfect symbolic act of just hiding under a pile of coats and saying, well, climate change won't be a problem if we're not actively gathering the data that tells us what a problem it is. So there's not won't be anybody to blame, except it's still happening. Right? I mean, it's all happening.
And I think, as you pointed out, it's there's a symbolism that, if you're talking to your supporters, you say, look, we hate these guys. We hate these PhDs. We hate these scientists. They're not like us. Let's defund all of their research, and let's fire them en masse from federal agencies and do stuff like this. So it also is, owning the libs, as they say, despite the fact that what it means is, it's like taking off the mirrors on your car or something, or blocking out your windows. You're gonna be rolling through an intersection. You're gonna get T-boned by a F-150 that you never saw, because we're not gonna see these disasters coming. This is one example, the ozone hole. We only discovered the ozone hole because we were monitoring the atmosphere. Nobody predicted the ozone hole. And it's so if you shut down all the monitors, You really wonder what would have happened. Would we have phased out
Right.
fluorocarbons?
Yeah,
And then,
and fortunately that occurred in an era where we still were somewhat proactive about taking care of this stuff. So we did implement legislation, we did curb CFCs, and the ozone is, correct me if I'm wrong, largely regenerated, or is that the case?
not quite yet. It's coming back. I mean, we can see recovery occurring, but the lifetimes of these fluorocarbons are basically like a century. So we're about 30 years into really the worst fluorocarbons. So we have a couple more decades before things are
So
better.
if this administration had been in power then, we would have just canceled all of that research, pumped twice the amount of CFCs into the atmosphere just for fun, and said, "Oh, well, screw you guys. We do what we want."
Yeah, no, it's, I often think about that. What would have happened if we discovered the ozone hole today? And I think the answer is we would not have taken action.
Fake news
Exactly.
from the woke Marxists. That's it. So, just the last part of my question was, so you're saying, fortunately, it doesn't seem to be the case that the currents will flat out stop, even though they've happened before, but slowing is still has the potential to be catastrophic, right? So what are some of the things, the effects that we can expect to see?
So remember what I said before, the circulation is what carries heat. And so if the oceans don't carry heat, the heat's got to be carried in the atmosphere, or you don't carry it at all, in which case tropics heat up and the polar region cools down. And so that could also happen. And that, by the way, is why when you shut this off, you get the, I don't know if you've seen the movie The Day After Tomorrow. But the whole idea of the day after tomorrow was based on the idea of this sort of this AMOC shutting down, where you get this massive cooling in sort of Western Europe, hot polar regions. So things change, and it's important to for everybody to realize that neither warming nor cooling is good for us. We are sensitively adapted to our present climate. Temperature goes up 5 degrees or goes down 5 degrees. Those are both bad options. So we don't want the climate to change because we have invested trillions of dollars in infrastructure into the
The
climate
climate
as it
being
is
this way.
now.
Yeah. Yeah, of course, inevitably they will just point to declining temperatures in like the UK and say, "See, there's no global warming." And then of course don't look at the tropics where it's rapidly heating and hurricanes are happening three times as often and stuff like that. So, yeah. Well, I think that's all I wanted to ask you about. I guess just to close, any other comments about the current status of Earth's climate in general? Anything listeners can do in reacting to this news?
Sure. So, I talk to students all the time, and sometimes the students come up to me and they're depressed, and I say, don't get depressed. Do not get depressed. Climate change is not a scientific problem. We understand the science pretty well. There's uncertainties, but not first order or zeroth or first order uncertainties. We understand the technology. We can largely stop using fossil fuels today. I mean, not today. It would take a few decades. But we have renewable energy that's clean and is cheap, so we can solve the problem. The reason we can't solve the problem is because of the politics. Fossil fuel interests are the most powerful special interests in the history of humanity. I say that all the time. It remains true. And so really, climate change is a democracy problem. It is not a scientific problem. It is not a technical problem. It's a problem of reclaiming the ballot box. And that's why, if you read the news, you can see there are these concerted efforts by some people to try to essentially shred democracy and stop people from voting and things like that. So what I tell students is vote, get involved, and not just vote. Voting is great, that's the minimum, but get involved, talk to people about it. Find politicians who share your concern and work with them. Phone bank for them, canvas, whatever the kids are doing these days. That's the most important thing to do. Make it a political movement because, people doing individually virtuous things like eating less meat or eating local or walking instead of driving, that's great. You should do that. It'll save you money. It'll make you healthier. And if you can afford to, put solar panels in your house. A lot of people can't do that though. But the one thing everybody should be able to do is vote in the U.S. This is a U.S.-centric description, by the way. Other
True.
countries have different issues. But if
Yeah.
you're in the U.S., vote, and vote for people who share your concern if you care about climate. And you should care about climate because you're going to live through this century. You've got skin in the game that Mitch McConnell, who
Doesn't
probably
have.
isn't going to live through this century,
Yeah, and my
he
kids
doesn't have skin
especially.
in the game.
Yeah, and luckily I do think that this administration is so unbelievably detestable that it's spurred a bit of some grassroots political activity, especially among younger people, for the reasons of climate and, you know, geopolitics and all kinds of other stuff. So we'll see what they and we all together can get done. So, yeah, thanks again for explaining that. Appreciate the clarity, and yeah, thanks as always.
No problem. Thank you.
Thanks, Andrew. Now let's speak with one more expert to get even more clarity. Michael Mann is Presidential Distinguished Professor of Earth and Environmental Science and Director of the Penn Center for Science, Sustainability, and the Media at the University of Pennsylvania. He is also a co-author of Science Under Siege, so he is no stranger to the anti-science forces shaping the current political landscape. If you've seen the famous hockey stick climate graph from the late 90s, that's his. Let's chat with Mike now. Mike, thanks so much for joining us here. So I wanted to talk to you a little bit about Lee Zeldin's EPA. As you know, the first thing I want to ask you about, I'd like to get your perspective on the recent repealing of the 2009 endangerment finding. What does it mean? Did you see it coming? What are going to be the main consequences for everybody?
Yeah, thanks, Dave. It's great to be with you. There's no question that the revocation by Donald Trump of the endangerment finding via Lee Zeldin was something that was planned well in advance. It was spelled out quite clearly in Project 2025, which was this blueprint by various organizations, conservative organizations like the Heritage Foundation, funded by the Koch brothers and other plutocrats, other fossil fuel plutocrats. For a long time, they have wanted to eradicate the endangerment finding, and this was their opportunity to do so. If they won back the presidency and Congress, they knew that they would have a clear path to doing so. And so it hardly came as a surprise to us, those of us who've been following this issue for some time. The endangerment finding, which originally was actually supported by, I would point out, a Republican EPA administrator, Christine Todd Whitman, supported the regulation of carbon emissions from coal-fired power plants, but was essentially overruled by others within the administration. It finally became law when Barack Obama was elected president. They were able to implement the endangerment finding. But it was actually, oddly enough, almost a brainchild of even Republican EPA administrators who once actually cared about the environment, who once actually believed in doing what they were tasked to do. And so this is the primary and was the primary really lever arm that the federal government has for regulating carbon emissions from coal-fired power plants, for implementing fuel efficiency standards on automobiles. And so it was really the primary lever arm for regulating carbon emissions by the federal government. And indeed, it is what allowed Barack Obama to make enough progress through the Clean Power Plan and other policies that they implemented, tighter restrictions on fuel emissions from automobiles. It was really through those executive actions, because remember, Obama was unable to pass climate legislation through the Congress, which was controlled by Republicans, or at least was filibusterable by Republicans. And so instead, he elected to act on climate through executive measures like the Clean Power Plan. It's what gave him authority when he came to the, face to face with the Chinese president, and they achieved a bilateral agreement back in 2015 that laid the groundwork for the Paris Agreement. And so, for a long time, fossil fuel plutocrats and the fossil fuel companies have been looking to eradicate the endangerment finding, and they finally had the opportunity to do so here.
Wow. Yeah, it's it does seem very heavily premeditated. In terms of the consequences, is it really genuinely just kind of now everybody pollute as much as you want? Is it that simple?
It is. It's the, you know, the fox guarding the hen house, if you will. And Fox is appropriate because Fox News, of course, has been spreading much of the climate denial propaganda. The conservative media have been spreading propaganda, attacking the Clean Power Plan, attacking the endangerment finding for years. And so maybe the analogy is even more appropriate than it appears at first blush. But it really is the fox guarding the hen house now, the people who are in control of energy policy, of environmental policy in this administration are literally fossil fuel lobbyists who are tied often to conservative you know, foundations like the Koch Industries. And so, yeah, they now are in control of the policy apparatus and have weaponized that apparatus to allow essentially unrestrained actions on the part of polluters, including fossil fuel interests. And it isn't just climate policy that they have been eradicating. It's really 50 years of environmental progress, the Clean Air Acts, the Clean Water Acts. These are policy interventions that some of which were actually implemented, again, by past Republican administrations. And so it's almost unprecedented to see 50 years of not entirely, but all, but somewhat bipartisan support for common sense environmental regulation, to see 50 years of that infrastructure, that policy go down the drain in a matter of a year and a half.
It is astounding. To pivot a little bit, because you're right, we're talking not just about polluting the air, but I want to get your perspective on the recent deregulation of PFAS, because Zeldin, but also to a greater extent Bobby Kennedy, really, you know, was a big part of his campaign, was saying, I want to regulate these toxic whatever, and he mentioned PFAS many, many times. Now this move, this joint move between Maha and Zeldin to deregulate PFAS, what's your perspective on that, and especially I'd love to hear your take on their stated justification for doing this.
Yeah, I mean, you know, their justification, it's always the same. It's it's pablum. It's boilerplate sort of propaganda, Orwellian almost, you know, because they'll talk about freedom and they'll talk about preserving, you know, the freedom of people to do what they want, when what they really mean is the freedom of polluting companies to infringe upon the rights and freedom of the people themselves who are harmed by these activities. If they really believed in, you know, small government, then they wouldn't be weaponizing the government to allow big polluters to basically have free reign in a way that hurts the individual freedoms of people themselves, of the people who are subject to the health consequences of these decisions. Now, one of the ironies, as you note, is that RFK Jr. was a champion of, you know, policies to regulate toxic chemicals. He was very much anti-glyphosate, the basic ingredient in Roundup that
he
is
deregulated,
you know,
that too.
So all of these things that he nominally should be in support of, somehow, under, you know, the sort of Trump, during the Trump presidency, he's allowing, you know, the opposite. He's allowing regulations to protect people against toxic chemicals to be eliminated. And he's been relatively silent about that. He should be outraged by these actions. Instead, he is focusing his energy on anti-science about vaccines that play to sort of the ideological views now of the MAGA world. And he strayed far from the path that he was originally on. He was once an environmental lawyer for the National Resources Defense Council. He was, you know, one of the primary proponents of a lot of these environmental regulations that were put in place to protect the health of people. And now in the name of Maha, he's actually supporting an agenda that does the opposite.
The opposite. Yeah, to me, it's always been a facade, a transparent facade, just campaigning on the basis of I'm going to protect you from the nasty chemicals. And then once you attain power, do literally the opposite, right?
It's a bait and switch. It's really a remarkable bait and switch. Yeah.
And then they justified with Biden and Harris did a liberal Marxism woke thing, so we have to undo that, and then we'll do a better thing later. It's just like,
right, which somehow never materializes, does it?
Sure.
Always going to happen later. Yeah. Yes.
We're
going to
get rid of the Affordable Care Act, and we'll give you something better later, except no, we absolutely will not.
Exactly. Well, because it's a cynical understanding of the way the news cycle works and the short-term memory of the electorate.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. So you're not new at all, obviously, to battling climate change deniers. You have a book, Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars. So you've been battling this propaganda for quite some time. I'm curious, from your perspective, can you say anything about the evolution of climate change denial over the decades? Is it the exact same thing, just they have more power, or do they have new narratives and rhetoric? Like, what's been going on?
Yeah, and that, in fact, was in part the topic of my more recent book with Peter Hotez, who's a vaccine scientist, Science Under Siege. And it's sort of an update of where we now stand when it comes to the assault on science writ large. It isn't just climate change. It's the science of vaccines and public health. Anything, you know, any area where the findings of science represent a threat to powerful vested interests like the fossil fuel industry, we've seen an effort on the right, almost exclusively on the right, to try to discredit that science. And as you allude to, it's sort of, you know, it's shifted somewhat, say, from the time when I wrote The Hockey Stick in the Climate Wars back in 2012, when it was the primary tactic of polluters and the bad actors who are trying to keep us addicted to fossil fuels and are doing everything they can to slow down the clean energy transition. One of their primary tactics was to deny that climate change is happening. But that just isn't credible anymore, because people can see with their own eyes the dire consequences of climate inaction now unfolding in the form of the record heat waves we've seen in Europe and North America just within the past couple weeks.
Yeah. And fires and hurricanes and just...
Absolutely.
It's now happening.
It's now, the predictions are, you know, unfortunately coming true, and people are witnessing that. They're experiencing that. They're experiencing the harm from that. People losing their homes, some people losing their lives from extreme weather disasters that have been amped up by the warming of the planet. And so the bad actors that we're talking about can't with a straight face deny that climate change is happening anymore. So they've shifted to sort of a kinder, gentler form of denialism, as I like to say, away from like the outright denial of like the physics of climate change itself, right, or a denial of the clear trends that we can see in the data, to other tactics that also start with D, not denial, but deflection. Oh, we don't need government action. It's all about individuals.
Consumer,
decreasing their own carbon. Exactly. Exactly. Classic deflection campaign.
Probably Matt Ridley's lukewarmism falls into this camp as well.
Absolutely. And there's sort of a delay, you know, in a lot of the lukewarmism is, well, you know, we have other ways of dealing with the problem, like massive carbon capture and sequestration. And so we'll figure it out, or geoengineering. We'll shoot particles into the stratosphere to block out the sun. What could possibly go wrong?
Maybe we will too, but let's also stop polluting.
Well, there's a worthy conversation to be had about whether ultimately we might need to, you know, intervene to prevent catastrophic warming. But right now it's being used as a tactic to, you know, to delay the obvious solution to the problem, which is, I like to say, when you're in a climate hole, stop digging and burning fossil fuels. That's the solution.
The gentler version would be, they're just trying to squeeze a few trillion more dollars out of it before they give up and let the shift happen. But, you know, that movie, Don't Look Up, if that taught us anything, well, you know, it'll go wrong at the last second and the asteroid will kill us all anyway. So,
that's right. And in fact, unbeknownst to most people, there was a very clear metaphor in the film
for
geoengineering.
Yeah.
the Peter Isherwell, the technocrat, the sort of Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos type character. And those people right now are actually putting massive funding into geoengineering. Mm-hmm. And so that was, in fact, Adam McKay's commentary on the dangers of these sorts of promises of future techno fixes as an excuse for business as usual today.
Exactly. And
I thought the movie did a great job in conveying that.
I can't believe how much he nailed it. It's such a good movie.
Yeah, underappreciated. And it didn't really get the critical reception it deserved. Yeah. And part of me wonders if that was because he was taking the fight to the fossil fuel industry.
A little too serious. Yeah, I think it'll be a cult classic. 10, 20 years from now, people will be like, wow, that was really, that's...
Along with Idiocracy.
That's the other one that I want. 100%. I love Mike Judge. So I learned this about you just from looking around. You've stirred up some controversy. You had some conservative commentators that sued you for academic fraud. Can you give us the brief story there, what happened?
Yeah, no, actually, it was the opposite. They accused me of academic fraud, and we took them to court. Two writers for the National Review and the Competitive Enterprise Institute, which is a fossil fuel front group, made accusations, actionable accusations, completely false accusations of fraud against me. And so we took them to court. It took more than 12 years to finally go to trial, which we did, and we won a unanimous decision awarding us $1 million in punitive damages. A Republican judge, the presiding judge is a Republican judge on the D.C. Superior Court, and basically cut that back to minimal damages. That is currently being appealed, and we feel pretty confident that we will win on appeal. Mm-hmm. And so in the end, it was, we were successful in sort of making sure that there were consequences for these sorts of false accusations, despite the fact that, there's still court challenges. I think a unanimous $1 million award of damages says something. It says something to the public that...
Sure.
You can't just lie about scientists when you don't like the implications of their findings.
Right. You can't just accuse someone of fraud for delivering facts that are inconvenient to you.
Exactly.
I mean, with the win, this is something that I think about a lot because I'm not well versed with the legal system. Do you think that the legal system is equipped to uphold the veracity of scientific facts, or is there just so much bureaucracy? It seems like in your case, even though it took 12 years, it did in the end. But is that something that is reliable, or did you get lucky?
Yeah, probably a little bit of both. Where we got lucky is that there is a trend towards politicization of the court that we're all aware of. All you have to do is take one look at the Supreme Court right now to understand that, precedent no longer means anything, at the highest level of jurisprudence in the U.S. Among six conservative Supreme Court justices. And we're even seeing that, in lower courts now, as judges are being appointed by Trump, Trump appointees are replacing, previous more objective judges. And so to some extent, I would argue we encountered that in our case with a Republican judge who did everything he could to beat back a unanimous jury decision on our part. Even though it was a jury trial, the judge still has some discretion. In this case, the judge used that discretion to try to minimize the damages and make trouble for us. And so I would say that that was a consequence of this trend that we're seeing towards the politicization of the court. And we can no longer, in my view, trust the courts to objectively litigate these sorts of issues.
Right. Yeah, that's the sense I get.
Comes back to the voters, right? Because that what that means is we got to turn out in numbers that allow Democrats enough power to expand the court, because that's what's going to be necessary. You expand the Supreme Court to redress the imbalance that right now is putting a rubber stamp on the polluter friendly policies that the Trump administration has has engaged in. Right now, the Supreme Court, for example, there's the so-called Chevron doctrine by this Supreme Court that basically said that, the EPA government agencies don't have the right to interpret federal statutes. Really pretty remarkable. And that was basically a gift to the fossil fuel industry to make it more difficult for courts to actually implement the laws that do exist. So it's all under attack. And the only way it's going to change is if voters turn out in big enough numbers, send a big enough message. And I'm hoping that we will see that in the midterm elections this fall.
Yeah, if they are allowed
if
to
they're
occur.
Fair. Yeah, if they're allowed to occur.
Yeah. I mean, speaking towards this administration, I'm not too old, not too young. I've seen a few administrations, but I haven't seen them all. Do you think that this particular administration is the most outwardly hostile towards science and the most subservient to oligarchy in modern times or American history in general? Or is it a little bit more typical? Am I exaggerating when I talk that way? Or what do you think?
Yeah, if anything, I don't think you are harsh enough. Not only are we seeing an unprecedented assault on science and reason under this administration, and that's what Peter and I talk about in the book, and Science Under Siege, it is unprecedented. You've got to go back to Lysenkoism, the era of Lysenko in Soviet, under Stalinist Russia, to find anything comparable. And in that case, scientists whose findings disagreed with the government dogma were literally imprisoned and died in prison or killed. And there were massive droughts famines that happened. You're familiar with this, that happened because of the implementation of those policies.
I compare this is the closest Bobby Kennedy all the time.
This is the closest thing that we have seen in American history, in my view, to something like that.
Yeah.
And it isn't just Trump. It's the Republican Congress and Republican Supreme Court that have put a rubber stamp on those policies.
Yeah, that was my thinking. I just wanted some corroboration there.
Well, we're in concurrence on that. Yeah.
So just wrapping up here, I mean, bringing it back to climate change, I was curious, do you see the sentiment of the public changing, the cultural landscape? Do you think people are more concerned about climate change? And if so, do you think that there's been any activity, whether among the media or science communicators or anything, that has been more or less effective in persuading the public to be more politically active about this?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think we are seeing the pendulum swing back right now, politically right now, against Trump, against the GOP. I think that will have implications for climate. I think it will create an environment where we will be able to try to pick up the pieces. Now, so much damage has been done. It's so much more difficult to build infrastructure than to deconstruct it, which is what this administration has done. So it'll take some time for us to build up the sort of policy infrastructure to actually make forward progress on climate. But I think there will be an opportunity for us to do that. And it's also important for us to realize that the U.S. no longer dictates the terms to the rest of the world.
Right. And
maybe that was once true. Maybe we saw in the World Cup yesterday that that's no longer true. Seemed like it was a metaphor for the fact that that the U.S. no longer is in control of what happens on this planet. And you see other countries like China seeing an opportunity here. China recognizing that this opens up the sort of the economic race of this century, where China is now so much out in front because of the efforts of the Trump administration on clean energy, renewable energy, electrification, that they are going to be the dominant superpower when it comes to the defining challenge, the defining revolution of this era, the clean energy revolution. We don't get to determine, where the train goes.
Right.
We just get to determine whether we get on board or whether we get left behind at the station.
Yeah. Yeah, we only control what goes on here, and unfortunately are currently dismantling the American scientific community.
Yeah.
So we will see what the ramifications are culturally, economically, et cetera.
Yeah, well, it's, again, if people turn out and vote, it really does make a difference.
Yeah.
Elections have consequences, and I hope that anybody who cares about the issues that we've discussed here will think about that this fall and think about everything that they can do to make sure that the folks that they know who also care about this turn out In every election. You can't stay home in the midterm elections. You can't stay home in the off-term elections, because
Absolutely.
If you do, they're going to make all that progress that we made is undone, and we've seen that happen.
They will make gains on the lower level and then climb it up the ladder.
Yep.
Well, that's all the questions I had. Definitely really, really appreciate your perspective here. I think that my viewers obviously appreciate the perspective. I do my best to convey what's going on, but it's absolutely crucial to hear from scientific experts and policy experts such as yourself. So thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you, David. It was great talking with you, and happy to come back anytime.
Thanks, Mike. While it's important to dabble in optimism in order to remain passionately politically active, and hopefully these guests have offered some assistance in that endeavor, we also have to remain honest about how royally screwed we are. Truly, this is the darkest timeline. Absolutely everyone in Trump's clown car of a cabinet is specifically antithetical to the job they have. We have a head of EPA who sides with polluters over people. We have a head of HHS who wants children dead from vaccine-preventable diseases. We have a head of DOD who bombs first and asks questions later while racking up security blunders like they're going out of style. We have a head of OMB who is actively dismantling the entire scientific community to create a $1 trillion slush fund. This is, without a doubt, the worst presidential cabinet in history. No other cabinet even comes close. And the damage they are causing will be generational in scope. These people are worse than serial killers. They knowingly cause devastating harm to the public for money. They belong in prison or worse. How will the rest of this term play out, and what fresh hell could possibly follow? There's no way to know, but I don't have a great feeling about it. So that's it for Lee Zeldin, yet another shit stain fueling the nightmare that is Trump 2.0. I will continue to comment on the activities of this administration as it pertains to science to the best of my limited ability. And trust me, there are many more figures to cover. Who will be next? We'll just have to wait and see. Until next time.